Thank you so much, and I'm sorry to be late. I was telling the last group, you know how it is. You want to come to APHA, so you submit like 6 abstracts. We got 5 accepted, so we're running between the rooms now to respond to those. But it's my pleasure to be with you here today, and we wanted to report to you our what we call Cancer Pain Project. It really was cancer symptom management among urban and rural populations in the state of Arizona. I have no personal financial relationship with anything, so there's no relationships to disclose. We'll move from there. Our learning objectives today is to identify the perceptions of pain as described to us by Southwest American Indian patients with cancer or survivors. Describe the barriers to effective pain management and to discuss effective strategies to overcome pain management, overcome the barriers. So we know the prevalence of cancer is lower in American Indian populations. However, cancer mortality rates are among the highest. And this can be due to late diagnosis. It can be due to misdiagnosis, less access to screening, longer intervals between diagnosis. We saw a lot of patients who traveled around a lot and went to different centers and went to different doctors. Most of our patients, by the way, said that they were diagnosed in emergency rooms. They came in through emergency rooms too because of lumps or other problems that they had. There's also potential medical mistrust and lower satisfaction with the care among American Indians. They often, in this area, they went to one American Indian nurse that provided them with a lot of attention, what have you. There was essentially very little dialogue between the provider and the patient, and there was a lot of mistrust. So we know that cancer is the second leading cause of mortality among American Indians over the age of 45. And pain is a common and feared symptom. You know, when I was younger, I was always told that if you have a lump that doesn't hurt and no pain, it may be cancerous. Till I had a lump that hurt and it was cancerous. And I was surprised to learn a long time ago that there is such thing as cancer pain due to the lump, due to any type of surgery, treatment, things of that nature. 30% of patients with newly diagnosed cancer will complain of pain. 50 to 70% of them receiving active anti-cancer therapy, such as chemo or surgery, will experience pain, and those with advanced disease because of trauma or nerve pain, things of that nature, will also experience pain. So pain is often a daily experience of cancer patients and survivors. Pain management is less adequate among minority populations. You may have heard of studies done 20 years ago where they went in emergency rooms and videotaped them, and women who came in getting ready to give birth, if you were a minority woman, you generally didn't get pain medication or you were overlooked. And so a lot of studies were done to check to see if it's because if you cry out more or ask for pain medication, how effective is that? But there has been quite a few studies showing that it's not adequate. Pain management is just simply not adequate among ethnic minorities. This isn't a part of this paper, perhaps the next one, but we did ask providers why they didn't provide cancer pain management to patients, and we often got the response, oh, these are tough Indians. They can take it. They don't feel pain that much. You know, they're good and robust and all this, and that was far from the truth. They should have provided cancer pain management along with anyone else. I can clearly remember one of the patient survivors that I interviewed and said, when you told your doctor you had pain, what did he say? And he says, well, on a scale from 0 to 10, what would you say is the strength of your pain? And the patient said, 13. And the doctor said, no. If you had a 13, it would be like a semi-truck ran over you, and you look fine to me. And I said to the patient, did you ever get pain medication? They said, no, he left the room. Got no follow-up, no pain medication. So we were quite surprised with this study and wanted to report on it because our patients are not getting the pain management and attention they need. We feel that many American Indian groups have a higher pain burden compared to other groups, and that's found out also by other researchers. American Indians may be more stoic about their pain and may not report pain. One of the other patients we talked to said, why don't you, just get up and say something to your doctor? A lot of the responses we got back was they had really a high respect for the profession, the medical profession, and they didn't want to be disrespectful, and they didn't want to challenge the doctor. They'd rather the nurse do it, but they had a real hard time communicating with the patient. There's been no studies of pain experience among American Indians in the Southwest to date that covers a lot of the information that we feel is necessary. So American Indian participants in our study, by the way, we covered the whole state. This was a R01 funded by NINH. They describe pain as having physical, spiritual, social, and functional components. It's mild to moderate on a daily basis, and it interferes with daily activities and relationships. However, many of these patients say that they don't share it with their family members, and they don't come in and complain enough because they feel the provider's not going to do anything about it, number one. And number two, they're of the feeling that you don't burden your family. You don't bring back your problems, your pain. You know, you deal with it best you can, but you don't overburden your family with your problems. And so there's very little outreach, and there's very little assistance to a lot of the cancer patients that we have seen. Studies show American Indians often utilize a combination of strategies, including opiates, pain medication, reliance on prayer, traditional medicine, that kind of a situation. They're most amenable to doing almost anything. It's not in this report, but I'll tell you something else that totally shocked me. Interviewed the pharmacist there, and she said, well, you know, sometimes they don't come back. So for a while there, we were giving them a year baggie of OxyContin. Really? And she said, oh, yeah, because if they don't come back or they go some other place, we just fill up a big baggie and give it to them. But you know what you observe going outside the hospital door? These young grandsons, young sons waiting there and get $5 a pop for the pills. And a lot of the patients didn't take some of the pain medication pills because they were afraid they were going to be addicted. So they just bypassed taking the pills. So our study was to reduce or overcome the barriers to cancer symptom, including pain, depression, function, and fatigue associated with cancer, with only adult American Indians. There were three phases. One was cancer pain interviews. I actually went into the Indian Hospital in the Southwest, got permission to interview active cancer patients that either came in for their chemotherapy or came in for their treatment. And they were asked if they would spend a little bit of time with us interviewing, so I interviewed 20 cancer patients. I was able to interview four of the providers who agreed to participate and agree to be interviewed. None of them, however, would agree to be taped. They seemed to be worried. They wanted to be in a quiet room. They didn't want to be tape recorded, but I could take notes, which I did, and it was at these interviews they were telling me how robust and tough Indians were, and they really didn't need the pain medication. We then followed up with focus groups with cancer survivors and their family members to better understand what they do to help the patient, help with things around pain. And by and large, family members were surprised at the ordeal the patients were going through. So we developed a toolkit that we tested. Too many T's, using a talking circle method. Cancer survivors were more than generous with their time. They participated in a videotape talking about their cancer, talking about what they do for cancer pain. They helped us produce a manual that advised other patients what to do. And it was really quite emotional. For instance, one of the patients he was 31, colon cancer, and he agreed to go be interviewed out in the mountains outside of Phoenix. So they went out there to interview him, and he was so emotional he couldn't get through the interview because he was now terminal. He went in with complaints of bleeding, and his doctor at the Indian facility said, oh, you just have hemorrhoids, don't worry about it, you don't need to do any more tests. went back and back again. Now he has stage 3 colon cancer, and they said that there's no hope. He hasn't undergone surgery. He doesn't know what to do. So he did a narrative for us on the side. Each one of them provided good advice and wanted to tell other Indian cancer patients that they also went through this experience and what they should do for pain and how they should reach out. So our project, which was a 5-year project, tested the toolkit and the talking circle method for informing patients and helping them manage their pain. So I did interview these cancer patients, and it was very interesting. You know how it is, you go out there and you have this 10-15 minute interview guide, and I'm going to interview them, and I was getting nothing back. They don't want to answer the questions. They were saying, "What? What did you ask me? Let me look at that. Oh, you want to know what?" And I could tell right away that the questions weren't helping any, so I said, "Why don't you just tell me your experience?" And they were most comfortable with telling their story about cancer. So they talk around a circle and finally come back to telling what happened. And often they were intrigued, as most cancer patients are, what caused this cancer? One man was an old rodeo man, and he told me how many injuries he had on the bull, what have you, and he really felt that caused his cancer. Another woman had 5 children, and she was 32, and she said, "I'm terminal. My mother won't talk to me about cancer. You know, what do I do?" She said, "It's okay with me. It's okay with the pain, but my husband drinks. I can't leave the kids with him. My mother won't talk about it, and there's no one for me to go to help me." She was told she was terminal. Another man, and I tell you, I cried with him. I just lost it. He came in and wanted to interview him and his wife, and he had a baseball cap on, and he took his cap off, and he was just bald, and he kept looking at the floor, and he said he wanted to contribute. So I told him to tell me his story, and he said, "My hair fell from the sky." And I said, "Your hair?" And he said, "Look at my hair, my Indian hair is gone." He said, "No one told me that when I went to get chemo that this is what would happen." He said, "I was taking a shower and it just fell." And he said he could barely go out in public looking like this. I mean, he was just those effects of cancer treatment that people didn't tell him was going to happen were the most painful. The meaning of hair in many communities is very strong. For instance, in American Indian communities, especially in the West and the Northwest, you cut your hair when someone in your family dies. And so it depends on their relationship to you, how close you are. You may cut a little bit, you may cut more. He had it all gone. And he had people asking him who died and things of that nature. And he said he felt like saying, "I did. I'm dying." And, you know, if the providers or they don't have counselors to help any of these patients get through it, the cancer pain is just one level of the experience these people are going through. So we had American Indians self-identified from the Southwest, but we also went into the urban areas where we got a little mixture of people. They were all delightful. They really were, and wanted to participate. We also, by the way, got tribal approvals for IRBs. Many tribes handle their own IRBs. They're able to because of the passage of 93-638 legislation that allows them to take over certain aspects of the federal government. And Indian Health Service, of course, had to go through that situation with us, and they've been fine, but all publications and all presentations need to be prior approved before this, and so that's what we work with. We did utilize grounded theory techniques to code it, to look at it. It was not just the words they used, but the meaning behind the words. In fact, we invited some friends of mine who were students of mine at UC Berkeley to come up to interpret some of the discussions and what have you. For instance, on tape, we had this whole discussion in this little community down there. People were saying, you know, they had cancer, you know, kind of things, and making all kinds of comments and kind of giggling and talking. And so I asked Anne to come in and meet with us, and she was a member of that tribe, and tell us what was going on. And she said, "Oh, listen to them. They're saying, 'What did you do? you got cancer? Well, what did you do? You know, kind of accusatory, that there must have been something that they did to bring this upon themselves. Another one of our doctoral students, who's brilliant, she's Navajo, she came in and she transcribed all the Navajo tapes for us and sat and talked to me quite a bit about the meaning and some of the situations and what we're told. And I found that interesting, although most people speak English, that cancer patients felt more comfortable talking in their own native language to describe some of the situations. So we analyzed it. Our oldest was 74. We had a lot of young patients. I went in there thinking we were going to have older population. We didn't. We had really a number of 30 and 40 year olds. We had breast cancer, colon cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, lung cancer, prostate cancer. And one of the meaningful findings I think we got out of this study is how being a cancer patient redefined their roles. Redefined it as a mother, maybe as a breadwinner, a member of the community. I mean, after a while, everybody in your community knows that you have cancer, what happened. It redefined their roles, and that's kind of something we're looking at. So the themes were the cancer pain experience, self-management, and what the barriers were. So they described often the aching pain, sharp pain like needles. Some of them described them like a cactus puncturing you, and burning pain. And I have to tell you something, and I'm not sure what to do with it, but if any of you want to advise me, about 10 of them drew their picture of pain, signed the back and gave it to us and told us what their pain was. Drew a picture of pain, what they were feeling. And I found that fascinating. That was not a part of our study, but they wanted to offer that to us to kind of explore it more. So you kind of see the difference between researchers who utilize certain methodologies, interview guidelines, protocols, what have you, and the respondent, the patient, the subject is trying to get you to better understand and using different ways of communicating, saying, see, don't you see this, what we experience. Pain intensity, many of them said it was unbearable or so much. When we asked them about the, you know, the little scale of the smiley and frowny person, they thought it was for children. That pain scale was just laughable. It was for children, and they're always asked that. Sources of pain, they kept saying it gets worse. It may be like a pulled muscle. They felt their tumor was leaking, things were coming out of that, and of course their chemo and other treatment was associated with their pain. There was no one time during the day generally that they had pain. It was steady or intermittent. They did describe the typology of pain, we're kind of working through that, what have you. Many of them could no longer work, could no longer provide for their families, couldn't take care of their children. I know several breast cancer patients after they have surgery, and it always amazes me, seldom are they told they may not be able to brush their hair anymore because they've had surgery to remove so much of the breast tissue and muscle they can't, you know, come on, how are we going to brush our hair then? And they don't tell you that ahead of time. I was a cancer patient years ago when my 30-year-old son was 3, and I couldn't pick him up. So I would squat, and I'd teach him, okay, climb up on me, then I can pack you. But I couldn't bend over to get him. I didn't have the strength. And so we see a lot of these patients here aren't helped through the process of working through their pain or what to do to take care of their daily tasks. Pain medication and patches often was offered to people. They didn't want to take pain medication. They didn't want to be hooked on it. And like I said, a lot of people knew the value of selling a lot of the, and OxyContin was the preferred medication. That just really surprised me. They were open to acupuncture, other things, massages. They were open to try anything. And they would get gel packs, rubbing, trying anything they can to alleviate the pain. Pain was difficult to control. Pain management often became the last treatment of choice. They would often try pain medication on trial and error, and they went around and shopped different doctors. They might go to the Indian Hospital, they might go to the clinic, a lot of them went up to Flagstaff, back and forth. they thought, I'll wait until I have the pain, then I'll take the pain pill, instead of making sure they had a certain level in their bloodstream to control the pain. They would save it until the pain got worse and then take it and hope that it had an immediate effect. Patient barriers were being stoic. They tolerated pain. They felt they had to live with it or not take the medication until it got too severe to handle. They said, I try not to take the pain medicine. It's just limited pain and I can live with it. Or I don't want to get into pain pills. It's something I don't agree with. Side effects of the pain pills, of course, was constipation, upset stomach, and drowsiness. They felt the providers showed lack of concern, inability to get their attention. They didn't ask about follow-up. Most of them didn't even ask them when they came for their visits, which I understand they should always. Are they in pain? Most providers did not ask them when they came in for visits at all. One patient did say to me that she said, you know, I have to go in and see this guy. And I asked to see my doctor, and he said, I am your doctor. And I said, no, you're not, and I want to see my doctor. And he said, I am your doctor. So I went and asked the guy. I said, oh, are you a doctor? And he said, no, I'm a public health nurse, but it's the same thing. And I said, no, it's not. Are you telling patients you're their doctor? And he said, yeah, they don't know any difference. I said, yes, they do. So that sets up a relationship where patients think that the providers lie to them. And it's not a trustworthy situation. Indeed, when I interviewed the nurse, Navajo nurse, who treated the patients, she was the one that told them what they needed to know and to help them, but she had to kind of do it on a QT because she was not allowed to. That was not in her job description. And I was not given access to interview her. So I interviewed her after hours. And I don't know what the facility was worried about. Here's a woman who was trained in oncology. She was a nurse. She was a tribe from the area. And they wouldn't let her counsel the patients. But she got in there anyway and did it as they were getting their chemos, or she was setting up appointments and stuff for them. Additional barriers. Factors identified were financial concerns. Working took a priority over pain management. We often heard from men saying, how can I not work? I have to work. I have to get up every day. Self-perceived roles. They felt they could not fill the role as a mother or a carpenter when pain medication took side effects. So they often wouldn't take pain medications. They said, I can't be a mother. I can't clean or cook for my family if I take that. So we know existing literature for many years document high pain burden among American Indians and evidence of inadequate pain management. I think mainly that we don't have the surveillance. We don't have the reports. It was quite difficult for me to get through this situation, and we finally had to go out to the tribal areas and get permission to recruit from within those sites for cancer survivors to interview them, because it was too difficult at this hospital. They allowed me to only talk to four physicians, and the four physicians were like, we're not taping this. If I talk to you, I want my name used. No tape, but they allowed me to take notes of it. So I don't know what they were afraid of, but I'm very concerned that our patients are not getting the care that they need, especially with cancer pain. And there is so much stigma going around about what pain medication does to you, and stereotypes that American Indians are tough and can take it and resilient and need not worry about what they say if they're in pain. They'll get over it. I was just taken back. I really was. So in summary, in addition to the patient and provider barriers, two additional critical barriers we identified: the impact of the self-perceived role obligations and financial concerns that often, I think, in Indian communities, a lot of people don't feel too concerned about. They feel like there's an Indian clinic there, there's Indian hospitals there, they can treat those that they need. But think about it, almost all of our cancer patients were misdiagnosed or late diagnosis to the state where they were terminal. And most of them were between the ages of 30 and 40. I was very much taken back. So we're aware of the interrelationship among these barriers, and it's essential for promotion of effective pain management. And so our project looked at self-pain management and had cancer survivors talk to cancer patients through a video and through a self-help guide. So I don't know if you're taking questions now or at the end if you have any questions. And if any of you want a copy of our guide or our paper, email me or let me know where to send things. We'll send it out to you.